You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 250 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Hello!
Episode
250. A quarter of a way to a million episodes.
Oh, no. I mean, we've really done... I haven't looked lately. I guess I could check this out from iTunes. We got to be pushing 400 actual episodes at this point.
Well, especially if you count.
you just trailed off there.
Emergency podcasts.
those are one of the things you would count. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talking Taco Time, Chef Series. There's a lot of things to count potentially.
Those who know.
Yes. Does it have the count here? No, it only goes back 200 items, so I guess I don't have an accurate count, but it's a lot more than 250, suffice it to say. But anyway.
There we go. There was one of those famous Pelton Cast pauses, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's what you have come to know and love over 250 episodes.
Oh, boy, that's a lot of awkward pauses that make you check whether the podcast has stopped playing or not. Well, buckle up. This one's going to be a ride.
Buckle up. Wow.
you don't agree with that?
I really don't know.
We're going to talk about the Mariners for maybe the most we've ever talked about the contemporary Mariners on this podcast.
Really?
When would it be? That, I guess maybe when they signed Ichiro and you talked about how much you hate Ichiro. a position for which you remain canceled in Mariners Twitter. But what we are drinking this week is from our friends at Elysian Brewing, the Full Contact Hazy Imperial IPA. You picked this up. What stood out to you about it? Was it the hazy or the imperial or the hazy imperial?
It was the hazy, and it was also the pagan-like can.
Yes.
I said, as we were heading into the first episode of Lent, if you will, I said that this pagan-like can was necessary.
Okay. Yeah, I forgot to post the photo of this on Instagram, so I'll have to get that up tomorrow. Do you want to tell us about this beer?
Experience by date on the bottom. Let's check that experience by date. 13 May 21. We're good. Our experience will be great. Full Contact Imperial Hazy IPA from our good friends at Elysian Brewing. Cloaked in a semi-translucent haze, an imposing presence beckons you to come closer. As you do, your nose opens to a tangent of wistful memories. Peach season in the orchard, a tangerine tree on a hill, fresh honeydew. Ah, God, honeydew. A fresh honeydew. Fresh honeydew cold from the fridge and a vanilla cream soda in your hand. What kind of bittersweet initiation is this?
There's some sort of a Bellevue Breakfast Rotary Club joke in here somewhere.
Wow, you're going to go hard on that, aren't you?
Sure am. We've got some toast this week.
Okay.
First off, coming up this weekend on Saturday at 7 p.m., the 86th annual Seattle Sports Star of the Year Awards. Obviously no, you know, traditional in-person gala, but will be broadcast on King 5 along with the simulcast on Sports Radio 950. Longtime Mariners manager Lou Piniella will receive the Royal Brougham Sports Legend Award. Third Pelton brother Jamal Crawford.
There we go.
Is the winner of the Paul G. Allen Humanitarian Award.
That's something I can get behind. I know that I didn't finish great in the Pelton Cast MVP voting. What are my chances of winning a Sports Star of the Year award?
Oh, they're very low. Actually, Jamal Crawford finished ahead of you in the Pelton Cast MVP voting.
So did Royal Brougham. No, we're not doing that again.
All right, next up. To UW-bound Jackson Grant and Duke commit Paolo Banchero, the two local players named to the McDonald's All-America teams earlier this week. There will, of course, be no McDonald's game this season, also due to the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
So, again, have fun there in Duke, Paolo, where they haven't had any success since 1998 when Grant Hill and Bobby Hurley were apparently part of the team, according to Tristan.
Wait, we're not doing throwbacks here, right? It's all about the future. Except for when I threw it back to last week a few seconds ago.
All right, next up, Bothell Zone. Actually, there wait, I put Bothell's.
Renton Zone.
He was born in Renton. Renton Zone, Zach LaVine, Bothell named Zone. An NBA All-Star Reserve, making his first appearance for the Chicago Bulls.
Bothell Zone, come on.
That's my bad on that one. All right, next up, pouring some out for the 11-year NFL career of former Seahawks guard Mike Iupati, who told the Spokesman Review that he's retiring. Iupati was a first-round pick by the 49ers out of Idaho in 2010 and started from day one in the NFL, earning four trips to the Pro Bowl and All-Pro selections in 2012 as a first-team pick in 2015. He finished his career with two seasons as a starter for the Seahawks at left guard, played his entire career in the NFC West, appearing for three of the four NFC West teams.
There we go. And also, when I was on the field for the pregame for the Seahawks game against the Rams last year, one of the largest individuals I've ever seen up close in person.
That sounds about right. Said, I fell in love with Seattle. The organization was first class. They were so good to me. So cool to see him go out with a relatively local team for where he started at Idaho. And not a huge surprise here. It wasn't expected that he was going to be back with the Seahawks this year. That was a position they were probably going to look to upgrade either way. But good to see him able to go out on his terms. He also said his goal was to play 10 seasons in the NFL, so he beat that one. Leslie, I wanted to note, we're coming to this point. Saturday marks 1 year from the last Seattle sporting event you attended, that being the Sounders CONCACAF Champions League shootout loss to Olympia.
And I think you have that date wrong.
How so?
Saturday?
Yeah.
Oh, the 27th is Saturday.
Yeah, it's not the same day. It's not the same day of the week as last year.
Okay, that makes sense. No, I was thinking that Saturday was the 28th. Yeah, and I will tell you that I think I was an earlier adopter to being terrified about the pandemic, but being at that event, I spent, Luca and I went to it, and we sat as far away as we could from anybody else. This was before we even really understood anything about transmission. You know what I mean? I think we were more concerned with surfaces than anything else.
For sure. I mean, that was the case well through when I went to the Sloan conference the weekend after this.
We were washing our hands. Like, I was wiping down every single surface around us, but we'd go up and talk to people right in front of us. You know, there was a lot that we didn't understand, but
I have a distinct memory of the crowd in the atrium, like exiting this match because of the fact that everyone was trying to leave at the same time at the end of the shootout. So yeah, that definitely stands out thinking back on this game.
Oh, yeah. No, you could be face-to-face talking straight into somebody's face, but don't shake hands.
No, absolutely not.
That's how coronaviruses are transmitted. But it was definitely like the anxiety level was getting ridiculously high at that point. We had a basketball practice, I want to say like the day before or something
It was on Tuesday, so I think they would have been 2 days before.
And there was a player who was sick. He was like, oh, yeah, I'm just a little bit sick. And I was out of my mind. And I was just like, everybody get away from Sayre. You know what I mean? There was like all sense was lost about us during this week leading up to it. And then also for the subsequent months after that. But I feel like this was kind of this week a year ago and the next week a year ago were probably the heights of my anxiety of my entire life.
I don't remember being nearly that anxious about this.
You fucking went to Boston.
Well, I mean, I was anxious by that point, but I don't remember it, you know, affecting my experience at the Sounders match. It's only retroactively that I think of the danger I was actually in. And then the next night, my last sporting event in Seattle was the following day, was the UAB men's basketball loss to Wazoo at Heck Ed in their final home game of the season. So,
I mean, I will never forget that ill-fated Sounders match that happened the following week where, you know, the stands were about half full. And just knowing that this was going to be it. Like, these events were going to start dropping like flies.
Well, we knew that there were going to be fans in attendance.
Yes.
I did not anticipate that you know, the leagues were going to entirely shut down as they did for an extended period of time before we just became okay with people taking the risk of contracting COVID for,
I mean,
to play sports.
A lot has changed in this last year.
A lot has changed, yes.
But the Monday morning, so I guess the 29th was Saturday, March 1st was Sunday. Monday, March 2nd, I was dropping the Middleist Fantasy Genius off at preschool. And you walk in and you kind of like mill about in the area before they open up the door for preschool. And there was like, I was looking around and I felt like I was in like pandemic movie. And it was like, there was a kid with a runny nose. There was a kid sneezing. Cause it's fucking March, early March, late February in Seattle. Every single child is sick. And they're just like, I was looking around and it was like, I was starting to sweat while I was sitting there waiting. And I did not go to work. The last day that I went to, that I have worked out of my office was February 28th, 2020. So we're going on a year. Through this week, it'll have been a year since I worked out of the office. But other people were going to the office that week. And I was like, I'm not, there's no fucking chance that I'm going around these other people. And Marco never attended another day of preschool either. It was just like, you're done. We'll see what happens, but you're done for now. And then now he's not in preschool anymore. So that was his last ever day of preschool.
There you go. Who knew at the time?
Whew. Yeah. I mean, we were like, yeah, it'll be a couple weeks. Two weeks.
I remember talking with the members of the Kraken's analytics department, like, well, you know, hang out at some point at Seattle when that's safe to do so. Like, you know, probably by May, it'll be fine. No, definitely. Definitely still not the case.
South by Southwest might not happen, but Coachella will be fine.
Well, that happy note.
No, it was just like, you know, when the whole, I feel like that whole week was one of those flashpoint moments where you kind of just, you remember almost every second of it because everything felt so intense.
But also because of the fact that you haven't had those same experiences since then.
Or before. I mean, it's nothing we've ever experienced in our entire lives.
I mean, that level of terror, yes, but I'm saying that, like, it's not like my experience of going out to lunch on the Friday before that UW Wazoo game was replaced by something else. Another time when I went out to lunch, was the it for going out to lunch.
Yeah, the wedding that I attended on February 29th, it's not like I've been to another wedding since then. Yeah.
So
it's mostly just fucking talking to you on this camera.
Oh man. Well, you know what else it is?
We've gotten actually a lot better at this too, though. So
we have. I went back and re-listened to the first.
Not at podcasting, for the record.
No. God, no. I went back and re-listened to the first episode we did via, at that point, Skype, and it was real rough. If you thought there was a lot of awkward silences now, it was really bad.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was noticeably terrible. But...
noticeably terrible.
Now it's only marginally terrible. The other thing we've done a lot of is getting takeout, and Hello. That leads us to our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, which continues with at long last Dre's Lake Route Eatery, which opened as Nate's Wings and Waffles. We mentioned last week that it's originally was set to be Fats Wings and Waffles there in the Rainier Beach location. Before a split between the chef and the owner, Marcus Lario, who ended up opening Fats Chicken and Waffles in the Central District. And then in steps Nate Robinson in 2014, near the tail end of his 11-season NBA career, to provide the financing to open this restaurant. And I remember being so excited when Nate's Wings and Waffles first went, going very quickly and taking a photo with my friend who I had lunch with and the members of Nate Robinson's family who were there working.
Of course. it was so exciting, man. There was the Nate Robinson, I think it was a Celtics jersey on the wall, right? Maybe a Knicks and a Celtics jersey?
There were multiple jerseys, yes.
Those are the two that I think I remember, were the Knicks and the Celtics, which I guess obviously makes sense. And also the location, right? Like the Rainier Beach location, it's very close to Renton. It's very close to Boulevard Park. It's kind of like the exact perfect place in between where we live that you
it
could
really
meet.
Is. Yeah. And that's why we've met there zero times.
We've met there before.
Oh, I guess that's true.
We met there multiple times. What are you talking about?
It's been a minute.
It has been a minute, but I mean, this is the first time I've been there since it was Dre's Lake Route. And I think the quality remains exactly the same.
Yeah. So what happened is they opened up a second location in Capitol Hill. And then at the start of the 2016, the ownership split and co-owner Andre Israel took over the Rainier Beach location and renamed it as Dre's Lake Route. Well, Nate's Wings and Waffles continued to operate in Capitol Hill until last year when it shut down. The menu largely remains the same, albeit with the addition of traditional breakfast food and more soul food on top of the original chicken and waffle heavy menu.
I noticed that with the breakfast food as well. And I think if we weren't doing a search for Seattle's best chicken, you know, I might have gotten an egg.
I contemplated on Sunday because I went twice. I had been, by the way, last year over the summer. And I went with the chicken and waffle the first time I went because I hadn't had that in a long period of time. And then what has become my staple there is the chicken and waffle sliders. And that's what I got when you went on Sunday and brought over food. And you went with just the chicken and waffle?
Straight up chicken and waffles. So these were bone-in chicken. These were chicken wings.
You got bone-in. I was given the choice and went with strips.
I ordered chicken and waffles. I didn't say anything else. I just said chicken and waffles. And got bone-in chicken wings laid out nicely around a waffle. I think there were five of them, I want to say. Some drumsticks, some wings, kind of laid naturally around the waffle. And I ravenously ate those. I mean, I was ridiculously hungry at this point because it's not a fast order. If you can't call in, they were a little bit busy. So I called ahead and the person at the desk was like, there's a 15-minute wait, but I can't take any phone orders right now. And so I went, I ordered. It was kind of funny. While I was waiting for my food, I got a phone call from a random number and it was Dre's Lake Route Eatery calling me being like, hey, did you end up coming? And then I was like, and she was like, did you get your food? And I was like, no. I was like, first off, how did you get my number? I was like, what is the process here? And she was like, oh, it's you. And I was like, all right, we're friends now.
Yes. You know?
Yeah. I called and then you couldn't take my order. And I actually showed up. But I ravenously ate the chicken after the wait. And then, you know, I don't know if it's a bone in chicken, it's tough to eat both at the exact same time. Right.
Correct.
Like turning it into a sandwich.
Well, especially with wings. Cause like yes. if you've got like a chicken breast or a thigh, going to Roscoe's, that's, you know, they're giving you bone in chicken, but you're able to like extract enough meat that you can eat a bite of that with a piece of waffle.
Turn it into a sandwich. Now, see, I think I prefer the idea of you eat your chicken and then you eat your waffle or whatever, keeping them separate at least.
I do not agree with that.
I'm not sure if I'm down with the chicken and waffle sliders. It's a little too sweet as a sandwich.
I mean, the whole point,
the waffle as the bread for the sandwich.
The whole point of it is the sweet and savory combination. That's why the chicken and waffle is America's best combination.
It's a great combination. I'm not questioning whether it's a great combination. I'm just saying rather than having both in the same bite, I want to have them consecutively.
I want to have them both in the same bite. Now, the one downside to this that I forgot about is that, you know, I drenched it with so much syrup when I had the straight up chicken and waffle that the waffle gets very soggy and then it's kind of hard to cut it up with the chicken. But that's only a limited downside because that means the waffle is delicious.
And I folded that waffle up and just ate it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it was great. A waffle and butter. Oh, my God. Now, before we go any further, though. Sweet potato fries.
Oh, yeah.
Hot, fresh, sweet potato fries. Are you kidding me?
And a healthy portion of them is a side with the chicken and waffle sliders. That's the upside of going that direction.
It almost makes the chicken and waffles taste worse how good the sweet potato fries were.
When I got the chicken and waffle, I went with the mac and cheese as a side, which is also a healthy portion. And it's actually like a penne pasta rather than actual macaroni, but it's quite good. I recommend that as well. I want to try the grits. I have not tried the grits, which you apparently can't get as a side. I think you have to get them as the main thing.
So this was kind of a tough one to judge for me because I feel like the chicken and waffle on its own together, my preference was probably for this over the Fats chicken and waffles. Again, understanding that I had the Fats chicken and waffles hours later, I did not have the perfect scenario to eat them. Whereas this, I was eating pretty fresh. I also didn't have the same sort of situation where I had the one larger chicken leg like I had at Fats. So it's pretty tough to have really have balanced the two of them and to have judged between the two of them. And I'm going to say, I think that I gave Fats chicken and waffles an 83.
No, you gave it an 88.
Oh, wow. I feel like this was like an 86.
Well, interesting. I felt like you were going the other direction with that. Now maybe this was my experience was different because I got the strips and not the wings, and then was able to eat them together with the waffle. And I would say that did you get the option of spice level?
No.
All right, I took the spicy strips, which have a nice kick to them. There was definitely some flavor, some solid flavor. I would say I slightly preferred it to Fats. So wow. I also gave Fats an 88. I gave Dre's an 89.
Wow. Well, so that's what I was going to say is I think I preferred the chicken and waffles together, but we are judging the chicken on its own. And the chicken that I had, the chicken leg from Fats Chicken and Waffles and the chicken wings from Dre's Lake Route, the chicken leg was just, it was a little bit better at Fats. It was a little bit more flavorful. It was a little crunchier. I would have loved to have had the option of spicy. If I would have known that was an option, I would have eaten the fuck out of some spicy wings, right? But we'll see. I think both are going to be in the conversation here.
I agree with that. I think they're very similar and requires more trips to parse between the two of them.
Well, especially knowing that there's spicy strips as a possibility in the world out there. Come on. Also sweet potato fries.
Yes. Yes. Ooh. Do you have any thoughts on where we should head next week?
No.
Very helpful. This is great podcasting as usual.
I've been really wanting to get to Soto Chicken. Are we able to go there? Do they only have chicken sandwiches?
We are able to go there. Hell, I'm yes. Pretty sure they have chicken in non-sandwich forms.
I've been wanting to go to Soto Chicken since it opened and have never been there.
Okay. Well, we can do that then.
Are they open on weekends?
They are open on weekends.
There we go. Yeah, I'll eat the fuck out of the chicken.
All right, they also have a chicken and waffle option.
Hold on.
The only thing I've done there would be they have bone-in chicken, they have tenders, they got everything here.
Wow.
As far as I can tell. And waffle is a side. So that's or they do have chicken and waffle as an option too. So that's worth considering.
Okay. Is this in the same location as the former Red Door?
That is correct, yes.
Wow. We're going to be doing some reminiscing next week.
By the way, so we posted about the butcher because I came across the menu for that when I was perusing. Mom brought over some drawings I had done as a child because that's a thing that she does while cleaning out her house. And one of them was on the back of a kid's menu from the butcher restaurant. And one person said that they recognized it, but the Bellevue location, which apparently is the original. So we learned a little bit about the butcher. It's a Schwartz Brothers restaurant. The one in Bellevue was the original Schwartz Brothers restaurant. They then opened one in Georgetown, which is where we frequently went as children. Those are obviously closed now. And all of the once massive Schwartz Brothers empire is now strictly consists of Daniel's Broilers in terms of sit down restaurants. So that was a little history.
There we go. The Soto Chicken logo is also the Wu-Tang logo. A little bit of history.
Do you think they've gotten a cease and desist?
Yeah.
Well, this is the last week of Seattle Burger Month at Lil Woody's. Whew. And going out with the Neon Torta by Monica Demas of Little Neon Taco and Westman's Bagel and Coffee, which features pulled pork cotija, sauteed onions and jalapenos, cabbage cilantro slaw, and avocado mayo on a tolera from Westman's. And they're really harkening back. I mean, the tortas, there are tortas on the menu at Little Neon Taco, but really, I think, harkening back to Tortas Condesa when that was open in Capitol Hill and was a favorite.
Yes, absolutely. Tortas Condesa. Excellent. Another one that for me was a bit of a victim of the takeout. You know, it just, it didn't travel as well as it could have. I had to reheat it. And some of the things that you're talking about that were in this, I'm like, oh, I had no idea.
The jalapenos weren't particularly forward. I was expecting it to be a little spicier than it was. You have no response to this? It was a zero?
I thought you were going to continue.
Oh, no.
That was it. But it ended up being, with the reheat, it was kind of dried out a little bit, dried out the bun.
And yeah, it's a downside.
It's tough. You know what I mean? Because I know that there was a very good torta in here. And I could taste it. The meat was great, but it was just like the subtlety, right? The avocado mayo, the sauteed onions, the jalapenos, those flavors didn't stand out as much as I would have liked them to.
I would say I got the avocado mayo, since obviously I was eating it fresher, going to pick it up before it was delivered to you. I mean, to me, this is the strongest field of Seattle Burger Month entries we've ever had.
Wow. How could you possibly remember that?
Well, not, I guess ever is too strong, because as we related earlier in this, I was a latecomer to Seattle Burger Month. In the period that we have been reviewing Seattle Burger Month burgers and doing every week on the podcast, it is the strongest top to bottom, I think.
Wow.
And very difficult to choose rankings among these four.
Okay. Do you have rankings, though, among these four?
At the end of the day, I think I would take the Cochiloco burger barely over the Dissoud burger. I think those were the two strongest. I mean, the Neon Torta is certainly a worthy contender, well worth getting. Probably not as novel because of the fact that it is pretty similar to the tortas that we're familiar with from Monica Demas. And then the Gully chicken sandwich was right up there too. I mean, again, top to bottom, just a really deep field this year.
I also love that this was just straight up a torta. It was Burger Month, but it wasn't like they didn't shove a burger in there, right? This was just a torta.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Which I like that they're kind of coming out of left field a little bit here. You know, it reminds me of Fast Food Month, where, you know, like they have done the, you know, crisp chicken burrito or crisp chicken. Yeah. Crisp chicken burrito, crisp beef burrito, Taco Time style. Right. Like there's no burger in there. And I like the idea of mixing it up a little bit. Three burgers and something else, I think, is pretty fun.
I mean, two burgers. Yeah, because the first one was a chicken sandwich, the Gully sandwich. Now, that is something that is within the Lil Woody's wheelhouse, as they have a chicken sandwich on the menu. This was more, a little bit more of a departure for them.
Yeah. I mean, we have got to go to, what is the Indian restaurant called again?
Spice Walla.
God, what are we doing?
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this. We're eating a lot of chicken.
Eating chicken.
Oh, I didn't even mention. I had the chicken sandwich that's new to the menu at Marination. I'm not sure if it's just the Mackay location. That's where I went and got it. It was really nice, crispy piece of chicken that had achieved an ideal ratio, I think, of crispiness for a chicken. And then it's got their sauce on it. So that's always a win.
Can we do like a time period, maybe spring, early summer, where we just do a run of chicken sandwiches? I know we said that they were going to be eligible, but can we just make them eligible? Even we could do a subset of the search for Seattle's best chicken and just do 6 weeks of chicken sandwiches and just crown a chicken sandwich winner during that time period.
Well, we're simultaneously reviewing fried chicken at this as well.
Maybe we put a pause on the fried chicken and just do chicken sandwiches.
We got a lot of fried chicken to get to.
I want to have chicken sandwiches.
No one is stopping you from having chicken sandwiches. I offered you this chicken sandwich. You turned it down.
It's a lot of work.
It is. It's fair. Should we turn our attention to sports?
Absolutely, we should.
Well, once again, surprisingly, we have your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
You know, it was a long weekend for the Mariners. I don't know if you heard.
I did.
But most importantly, out of anything that happened, I want to thank Kevin Mather for his 25 years of service. I mean, just look at this resume. Sure, the team has the longest playoff drought in American professional sports, and he was accused of workplace misconduct by three women, causing them to leave the organization. But have you seen that Root Sports deal? And also, so maybe he alienated the Mariners' only successful draft pick of the last two decades and both of the hottest young prospects in the organization and their ace pitcher and also their legendary Japanese star and also a solid role player. But check out those net profits from 2020, sucker. That red line don't lie. And those service years, they ain't going to manipulate themselves, brother. And honestly, who really cares that they fought tooth and nail against basketball coming back to Seattle and being played in the SoTo area? And that the whole neighborhood is trash anyway, just like the city of Everett, Washington. The only thing it's good for is $40 parking in their government subsidized garage. This guy has a lot to take credit for. I mean, without those 25 years of service, we wouldn't have that iconic Mariners phrase. Get out the rye bread and the mustard, Grandma. The Mariners have saved $75,000 on a foreign interpreter. I don't believe it. My, oh my.
You've outdone yourself. People were anticipating this as soon as the news broke. And yeah, lived up to expectations. So, as you've no doubt heard by this point, M's president and CEO Kevin Mather resigned Monday after outrage over a video of his speech to the Bellevue Breakfast Rotary Club on February 5th became public over the weekend. There was a nice story in the Seattle
Whom's
Times.
Amongst us? Whom's among us has not had a defamatory speech to the Bellevue Breakfast Rotary
Club? No, it was flammatory. It was inflammatory even.
Inflammatory?
Not deflammatory. Just certainly not that.
Breakfast Rotary Club.
Mather joined the Mariners in 1996 as their executive vice president of finance and oversaw the construction of T-Mobile Park in that role before being named president and chief operating officer in 2014 after the retirement of Chuck Armstrong, who was promoted to CEO in December 2017 while retaining the president title. As you mentioned, in 2018, the Seattle Times reported that it was actually two female executive assistants had filed complaints to HR related to Mather's behavior. The third complaint was related to Chuck Armstrong's behavior.
Okay.
The assistant to then executive vice president Bob Aylward said that Mather had repeatedly rubbed her back and made suggestive comments that made her feel uncomfortable, while Mather's own assistant said he made her uncomfortable with inappropriate jokes and comments about female colleagues. At the time, Mather oversaw the team's HR department, which was subsequently placed under Armstrong, then the president, despite that HR complaint against him, which came the following year. The M's reached confidential financial settlements with both executive assistants who left the organization while Mather remained and was subsequently promoted twice prior to that becoming public knowledge. Where should we be? Should we go through the transcript, some of the key comments here?
Well, sure. But I want to talk about, good God, you've got a lot. Offensive statements is a category for you.
Well, there was offensive statements. And there was things, just things he shouldn't have said, but did say.
The most important takeaway is the Mariners, of course, have handled this completely wrong. And the statement that they gave, including the thanking Kevin Mather for his 25 years of service, despite these complaints that happen against him, this is not a Kevin Mather specific incident. This is the people at the organization saw these complaints that happened in 2010 and promoted him twice.
2009
2009 and promoted him twice within the organization. Right, this none of this is new. The biggest issue here is that it became public. right? This is something, the attitude and the perspective is something that the Mariners were comfortable with for decades. And the real issue here is that everybody else found out. And I think that's...
I want to summarize this at the end. Let's go through what he actually said first.
Okay.
And then get there.
Okay.
And then go through the fallout.
We'll come back to that.
All right, let's start with this. He was asked about top prospect Julio Rodriguez.
This is your offensive statements section.
This is. We're going to start from most offensive. This second is probably the most offensive. And then get to least offensive, I think. That's my relative. Your mileage may vary. Julio Rodriguez has got a personality bigger than all of you combined. He is loud. His English is not tremendous. But he and Jared Kelnick, the team's other outfield prospect, are very good friends. Fantastic kid, skipping forward. We're really big on social media. He loves to get out in front. He loves the Mariners. And between him and Kelnick, we've got an outfield that would be as good as any in baseball for the next 6 years. He's the real deal. He's ranked higher than Kelnick, which, as I said, Kelnick doesn't lack for confidence. Kelnick is not happy that he's the fifth highest prospect in Baseball America and Rodriguez is the fourth highest prospect. It's little things that bother Kelnick. Obviously, the English not tremendous line here attracted a lot of attention, including Julio Rodriguez posting on Twitter a photoshopped meme of Michael Jordan from The Last Dance saying, "I took that personally," with him photoshopped on that.
Just really incredible across the board. Everything, the offensive part about Julio Rodriguez, really even insulting all of the people at the Bellevue Rotary Club too. He managed to sneak that in, saying that Julio Rodriguez has more personality than all of you combined. Right? So it wasn't even the players in the organization.
Wow.
It's the fucking Rotary Club too.
Wow.
But the comment, obviously,
definitely not going to have him back next year.
Yeah, we'll see. It's a big moment for the Bellevue Rotary Club. But the offensive comment about Julio Rodriguez not speaking great English, which just... And then also kind of like basically saying that Jordan Kelenic is petty Jared Kelenic. Look, this is still baseball. I don't know that much about what's going on. Jared Kelenic is petty or lacks confidence or whatever about being the fifth best prospect in baseball. It's just like boom, boom for both of them, plus the audience in attendance.
There's a lot more coming for Jared Kelenic. We'll get to it.
Oh my God.
That wasn't the other stuff about Jared Kelenic. I don't think I even put in the offensive section because there was so much else. All right, later, he was asked about how the team helps international players learn English. He talked about what they have done to do more to help players from Latin America who are coming up through their farm system, but then was speaking about players who come from Japan and Asia at more advanced stages of their career and had this to say. For instance, we just rehired Hisashi Iwakuma. He was a pitcher with us for a number of years. Wonderful human being. His English was terrible. He wanted to get back into the game. He came to us. We quite frankly want him as our Asian scout interpreter. What's going on with the Japanese league? He's coming to spring training. And I'm going to say, I'm tired of paying his interpreter. When he was a player, we'd pay Iwakuma X, but we'd also have to pay $75,000 a year to have an interpreter with him. His English suddenly got better. His English got better when we told him that.
Are we going to go through all these before contextualizing?
We can pause on this one. This is probably the biggest one. This is the first one I saw on Twitter, at least. I don't know about you. Hisashi Iwakuma in 2017 made $14 million. I don't know that the $75,000 for the interpreter was that big of a fucking deal compared to that.
It doesn't matter if it was a big deal. It's also just like the sneaking in of it. Wonderful human being. His English was terrible. It's just like, are you why? What the fuck? Like, why is this even a thing that you're thinking about? It seems to me like he is dwelling so much more about Hisashi Iwakuma's English speaking and paying for the interpreter than anything else. This is the most important issue to Kevin Mather here.
It reminds me of a mentality that I'm familiar with from working in sports, which is that there's this strange dichotomy between the money you spend on salary in on other areas, where the $75,000 you spend on an interpreter can seem like a bigger deal than the $14 million you spend on the player. But yes, I mean, the other thing here is You know, often Japanese players like to use interpreters for a variety of reasons, even if their English is good. I mean, you know, because of the fact that it allows them time to think about their answer. For example, while the question is being interpreted, you potentially fear slightly misspeaking and being made fun of for that. I mean, there's a lot of value to it. And he completely ignored all of that and just said, you know, you have to speak English, basically.
And we're also talking about the 0.5% of money. Like, I think that there was, I read the Dome and Bedlam piece, Mathers All the Way Down, which I thought was great. And it was really just this perspective, which kind of permeates throughout everything he says, of really not understanding what he should be doing. And so instead, like you were talking about, focusing on these small issues, right? We're talking about a $1 billion organization across the board. And he's concerned with bringing up in this moment $75,000 to an interpreter.
How like proud he was to have saved the $75,000.
Oh, yeah, this is something that as the CEO and president of this fucking team, he is so proud of himself for saving them $75,000 for an interpreter to make one of their star pitchers feel more comfortable. It's just like, it's ludicrous that this is something that he has honed in on, right? As something that should be under his purview in this position.
All right, let's continue with the offensive statements. He said that this is probably Kyle Seager's last season as a Mariner, and also said that Seager is, quote, probably overpaid, something that a number of sources have pointed out over the course of his career. If you look at the value he's provided, he clearly has been underpaid by the Mariners. He called pitcher Marco Gonzalez, quote, very boring, which is now Gonzalez's Twitter bio, and per multiple reports, embellished a story about Gonzalez confronting a former Mariners teammate who he quite clearly indicated was Mike Leake. Asked about minor league realignment. They asked us if we wanted to stay in Everett. We quite frankly like the owner in Everett. We thought he was a good person. We like the location of Everett. We don't particularly like the facility called Everett. We talked to the owner. We could have gone to Spokane. We could have gone to Vancouver, BC. But the problem with Vancouver is that you run into visa problems, particularly when you bring kids from Venezuela and the Dominican and try to get them across the border for a 3-game season. I guess that's supposed to be series. Then asked about putting the team's prospects on the 60-player roster or I guess this was when he was summarizing the 2020 season and how they put the team's top prospects on the 60-player roster. There was no chance you were going to see these young players at T-Mobile Park. We weren't going to put them on the 40-man roster. We weren't going to start the service time clock. There were all kinds of reasons that if we had an injury problem or a COVID outbreak, you might have seen my big tummy out there in left field. You would not have seen our prospects playing in T-Mobile Park, which, along with some later comments about Jared Kelnick, quite clearly indicate manipulation of service time for those prospects.
Well, I mean, this is an infrastructure issue for baseball also, right? Is that the teams can make these choices with regards to service time.
Not just that they can make these choices, but that they're incentivized to make these choices. I do put this blame on baseball. And this is a case where, like, the whole thing was him saying the quiet part out loud, but this was him saying the quiet part out loud in a way that it hopefully will be beneficial in terms of baseball getting its shit together. Because when you've got a rule that forces teams to keep their best prospects in the minor leagues longer so that they don't, you know, can accrue an additional year of service time. And like, it's logical that they do that. Alex Rodriguez was a free agent in 2000 after the 2000 season, instead of after 2001, because the Mariners didn't manipulate his service time correctly in 1994 and 95. Like, that's what happened.
This guy in charge.
They
would have missed the playoffs, but you know.
Alex Rodriguez on the 2001 Mariners is quite a hypothetical what if. But baseball's rules are just messed up. It's bad for the players because they get stuck in the minor leagues for longer than they deserve. And it's bad for the teams because they don't bring their exciting top prospects up to the major leagues as quickly. MLB Players Association, the onus is on MLB here because they're the ones that are fucking up, have to figure this out in the new CBA.
Do you think this is a trade-off where it's like, look, there's not going to be a salary cap. Players are going to be able to get paid whatever they want once they become free agents. But to get there is going to be ridiculously hard.
I mean, that's probably in practice what has happened is like MLB is demanding significant concessions from the Players Association in exchange for making changes here. And that's why it hasn't happened. That's why the Players Association hasn't pushed for it. So
you're willing to let the ghouls in the front office manipulate your playing time so long as you can sign a 14-year deal once you actually become a free agent.
Well, we'll also talk about long-term deals in a bit here. That's going to come up. Actually, it's the next one, even. We move now into merely things he shouldn't have said publicly about the Evan White extension. He took a lot of heat for signing that deal, which, by the way, you'll recall was the first ever for a player to sign a long-term deal before appearing above double A. Went back and listened to our hot takes on that one.
What did we say?
We said that he should sign Baby Fantasy Genius. Not he, but the Mariners should sign Baby Fantasy Genius to a long-term deal. Like, really get ahead of that. The union really pushed back and said, don't do it. But I like Evan White. He's a nice young man. And he made the comment. He said, I have $23 million guaranteed. That changes a person's life. I'm signing the deal. And if I'm good and they pick up my options, I'll have $55 million guaranteed. That changes my family's, my grandkids' lives. I like the young man. We will offer more long-term deals. Now, one of the people they offered this long-term deal to is aforementioned top prospect Jared Kelnick.
Also noting, I mean, of the players so far who have been insulted, we've got the basically people of color across the board. Evan White, though.
Kyle Seager got insulted for sure.
Kyle Seager being the one. But also, this is a nice young man in Evan White. The person who took the deal that was a team-friendly deal is a nice young man. Okay.
So Jared Kelnick turned down their offer. We offered him a long-term deal, six-year deal for substantial money with options to go farther. After pondering it for several days and talking to the union, he's turned us down, and in his words, he's going to bet on himself. He thinks after 6 years, he'll be such a star player that the seventh, eighth, ninth year's options will be undervalued. He might be right. He might be right. We offered, and he turned us down. So this is where we go back to Evan White is a nice young man because he decided to make this decision. And Jared Kelnick doesn't get the nice young man because he made the opposite decision. He gets very confident is the description that came up repeatedly.
Very, very confident. And also concerned with being the fifth best prospect and not the fourth.
That was part of the confidence. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, there's nothing, I don't think, morally wrong with the Mariners making these kinds of offers. Clearly, there is a leverage issue here where, yes, these are players that have made very little playing in the minor leagues. And so $23 million is a life-changing amount of money for them, even though it might be less than they're actually worth. And that's why the union didn't want Evan White to sign that contract.
I think there is something morally wrong with it, but okay.
About Jared Kelnick's timetable. We would like to see him get a few more at-bats in the minor leagues, probably AAA Tacoma for a month, and then he will likely be in left field at T-Mobile Park for the next 6 or 7 years, and then he'll be a free agent. Possible attendance this season was one of the questions. The Seahawks tried to get fans for their playoff game, and I told my staff, I said, let's just pull their coat and stay out of this one, and they were not able to do it. We have designs.
What does that mean? Can you explain what he's saying? He's saying we stayed the fuck out because we didn't want to push.
Yeah, just like ride their coat. And if they get fans, then we'll get fans. But if not, then we won't. Which, by the way, the Seahawks playoff game came during the height of COVID cases in Seattle. So that would have been an absolutely terrible time to allowing fans.
But when he says ride their coattails, right, pull their coat, which is a phrase I've never heard before, and stay out of this one. What does that part mean?
That they weren't going to like make the case for the Mariners or for the Seahawks, like go in and advocate. So that's how I interpreted it, at least.
Okay. Finish the horrible statement.
I mean, I don't think it's horrible, but, and I told my staff, we have designed socially distanced T-Mobile Park will hold 9,870 fans, and those are pods of four. I'm afraid one of the issues the county is going to have us do, at least in April and perhaps May, is the pot of four has to be from the same household. And how do we enforce that? We're working closely with the county health officials. Some ballparks will have fans. Texas, Florida, they will have fans, and not as socially distanced as perhaps we will be at T-Mobile Park. The state of California, we don't think they're going to have fans all year. So we're working on it. My best guess is small in April, bigger in May, bigger in June, perhaps big crowds in July, August, and let's hope in September. We're pushing for a playoff spot and when we have big crowds in September. That's my guess that it'll phase in. And my guess is masks will probably be mandatory in the first half.
Probably just wrong in general. But the piece about this fucking team. I swear to God, what is with the fucking Mariners? And just, they can't participate in the greater sports community. They have to be assholes. Is it just this guy or is it the entire fucking culture? They had to try to sabotage basketball in Seattle. They had to come out and say, if I'm the Seahawks, I look at this and be like, the Seahawks are the most important sports team in the entire city. And you're here saying publicly, we weren't going to support you. You know what I mean?
Oh, he also trashed the Seahawks championship parade.
What would he know about a championship parade? Exactly. What would the CEO of the Seattle Mariners have to say about a championship parade?
He apparently did work for the Twins when they won World Series. So,
what year was that? Where was he at? I mean, come on. Trashing the Seahawks championship parade? He's like, the goal is not to go to the playoffs and to win Super Bowls. The goal is for net profits, people.
I mean, look, that is a Grand Mariners tradition.
Oh, I hate this team. All right, everything about them. Ugh.
Some other quick hitters. This was my personal favorite. This was like the most revealing comment. He referred to MLB's inability to get the Players Association to agree to postpone the season for possible vaccination of players as, quote, embarrassing, and said that the timeline they were suggesting to players was based on advice from Dr. Fauci. But, and I quote here, I'm not supposed to say his name. And then the next thing he says is his name. Like, his statement about this before resigning termed it a lapse of judgment. I don't think it's a lapse of judgment when you say, I'm not supposed to say this. And then you just say it. Like, that's the whole fucking thing.
But it's also, out of all of these statements, this was the one where he was like, hey, I might have overstepped there for a
second. Oh, no. He also said that we'll have, quote, we'll have an electronic strike zone within 2 years, which, given the reports that he's embellished some of the other things in this, who knows how much to wait to put on that, but that was interesting.
that falls under the category of kind of interesting things that he said in this long tangent.
I mean, it was the two things. Number one, I checked out the transcripts at both Lookout Landing in the Seattle Times. Lookout Landing was the first I saw to have one, who also kind of was at the forefront of making this story public. It's a long conversation. But the other thing is, the video cuts out midway through an answer. There might have been more shit out there that just didn't get put on video. Never know what kind of heinous shit he could have said after the video stopped. My ESPN colleague Jeff Passan reported Monday that the, quote, the mistrust sown by his comments reverberated deep in the player ranks Sunday, sources told ESPN. The gamut of feelings ranged from angry to sad to what the expletive was he thinking. And this is why, like, there was some question Monday morning. I never thought there was any chance he could have survived this, although the Mariners never had to make that decision. And one of the things that, let's go now to the statement from chairman and managing partner John Stanton. Like all of you, I was extremely disappointed when I learned of Kevin Mather's recent comments. His comments were inappropriate and do not represent our organization's feelings about our players, staff, and fans. There is no excuse for what was said, and I won't try to make one. I offer my sincere apology on behalf of the club and my partners to our players and fans. We must be and do better. We have a lot of work to do to make amends, and that work is already underway. Kevin Mather has resigned his position effective immediately. As you mentioned earlier, I want to thank Kevin for his 25 years of service to our franchise. I will serve as acting president and CEO until a successor can be chosen. Everyone at the Seattle Mariners remains committed to our mission of winning on the field and serving our fans and communities off the field. We will demonstrate that commitment through our actions. But then when he had a media availability and was asked whether he would have fired Mather had he not resigned, demurred and said, I didn't have to make that decision. I came in this morning and Kevin resigned. I believe that's the right answer for the organization.
This fucking team.
Should we go through other statements?
Sure. It just keeps going.
Well, these are not from Kevin Mather. These are other statements from people about the fallout. The Major League Baseball statement, we condemn Kevin Mather's offensive and disrespectful comments about several players. We are proud of the international players who have made baseball better through their outstanding examples of courage and determination, and our global game is far better because of their contributions. His misguided remarks do not represent the values of our game and have no place in our sport. And one thing Stanton said was that he did talk to Major League Commissioner Rob Manfred, saying, "I value his cancel. This was entirely a local decision, but we're part of a larger universe within Major League Baseball. And I thought it was important to both apprise the commissioner as to what was going on here, as well as to seek his advice." MLBPA, the Players Association, released a statement. "The club's video presentation is a highly disturbing yet critically important window into how players are genuinely viewed by management, not just because of what was said, but also because it represents an unfiltered look into club thinking. It is offensive, and it is not surprising that fans and others around the game are offended as well. Players remain committed to confronting these issues at the bargaining table and elsewhere." Some other comments: Jerry DePoto, the team's GM, "The thing that was most bothersome was the tone and the tonality of the comments. They were hurtful or insulting to a lot of people, and I made sure that our players knew that that wasn't the way we see it." Manager Scott Service said, "For me personally, I got to say I was very angry. I was embarrassed, and I'm frustrated because I know how hard we are working as a group to create a culture that we're proud of, and I feel very strong where we've done a lot to do that. That's why the last couple of days have been so hurtful." I mean, that's the thing, is like, this should be the most optimistic time of year. The Mariners held their first full squad workout on Tuesday, and the storyline is not about the team. It's not about the young prospects. It's sort of about the young prospects, I guess. It's about Kevin Mather.
In a way.
Like, several people, including Marco Gonzalez, brought up the fact that it's a distraction, and it just hammers home like what bullshit it is when people talk about, oh, Colin, we can't sign Colin Kaepernick, it might be a distraction. No, the real distraction is your goddamn CEO, who should not, no one should know their name, actually.
I makes, never once. You said that we probably had talked about this when the Seattle Times story came out.
We definitely talked about it at that point.
But if you would have been like, who's the Mariners CEO or whatever, I'd be like, I don't fucking know.
It's the last thing you should be. I mean, it's kind of to me like the Brian Colangelo situation. Obviously, it's very different in many ways, but it's the same thing where private thinking becomes public in a way that can't happen, and that ruptures trust with players. And that's why he couldn't continue. And I think the thing you mentioned earlier is, I do think that his comments, his offensive comments about players' ability to speak English in particular, are Kevin Mather's individually rather than the Mariners as an organization. But as you note, like, the odds are these aren't the first time Kevin Mather has said these things. We have a track record, and this is an organization that has not earned the benefit of the doubt at this point.
Absolutely not. No. And I that's the part that it's hard to not continue to come back to, which are like, somebody goes out and makes these statements publicly that they shouldn't have made. But the reality is, this feels like a culture that has permeated throughout the Mariners for decades. And it's what makes this team so hard to follow, right? Like, the idea that there's a generation of people who've grown up as Mariners fans is, it's like, I don't know why. Like, I don't know what it is that is drawing you to this team in particular. This is not about the sport of baseball. It is the Seattle Mariners. There is a poison that exists throughout the culture of the Mariners and has existed throughout the culture of the Mariners for decades. And we're seeing it publicly here. And it was said publicly, but it's so clear that it has been lingering on the executive side and on the back end and the front office for generations, right? There is a person who had these perspectives who kept getting promoted, right? Who managed to be accused of workplace misconduct and be promoted multiple times, and then have a Seattle Times story about workplace misconduct and not be fired then, right? Like, the fact that he managed to make it through that and not be fired goes to show just how deep to the core of the Seattle Mariners this goes, right? Like, looking back on it, you look at it and you're like, what the hell? After this, how did that Seattle Times story come out and he wasn't fired then? And you even look at it now and you're like, did John Stanton really intend to fire Kevin Mather in this moment? Is that what was going to happen for the Seattle Mariners? Or were they going to see if this blows over? Because it really feels like, I just don't think they really understand how important these issues are. And I think the real issue is that it got to the players. And I think that that's that's why he is no longer the CEO and president of the team. And when it was just employees, when it was just femme employees of the team, it didn't matter that much. The $500,000 didn't matter that much to the team. The $75,000 mattered a hell of a lot to Kevin Mather, but the $500,000 didn't matter that much to the team.
Wait, what? $500,000
in settlement money that they paid out.
I forgot that there was a specific number associated with that.
I believe that was from the Seattle Times piece. Mm. But it's just a deep to the core. And do I think that Kevin Mather is probably a very sad man who didn't have a lot of agency on the baseball side, really wanted to take credit for a lot of things, really wanted to showboat for the Bellevue Breakfast Rotary Club? Of course. You know what I mean? But like, there's no way that this happens without a culture of nurturing this type of perspective. And that the Bellevue Breakfast Rotary Club was not looking for him to say that Sasi Iwakuma's English got a lot better after they said they wouldn't pay for his interpreter, or that Julio Rodriguez, is that his name?
Yes.
That Julio Rodriguez's English is not that great. And it's like, nobody was looking for that. You didn't need to include this. This didn't have to be, this wasn't part of the conversation. And nobody wanted it to be part of the conversation. And the fact that he did it, I think it really shows, again, just how ghoulish the people at the executive level of this team really were.
I mean, I think one thing I'll say in the defense of the Mariners organization is I think you can extend that to Kevin Mather and on up. I don't think you can necessarily extend that below him. And, you know, one of the things that's a bummer about this is that as awful as the product the Mariners have put on the field has been over the totality of the past two decades now since 2001.
Now, did they make the playoffs in 2002?
They did not make the playoffs in 2002.
Oh, 2001 was it?
2001 is it. I attended their final series in 2002. And suffice it to say, there was no champagne celebrations there in Anaheim. You could feel good about the Mariners marketing and many of the things about the experience at T-Mobile Park, like their, you know, offerings of craft beer. They've upgraded the food offerings tremendously, although there's probably still some more work that could be done on that front. And, you know, I know how it feels to some extent to be like not in a position of decision-making power and feel like your organization is making bad decisions that are reflecting poorly on you because you're an employee. Like, I worked for the Sonics.
You're saying to the low-level staff, right?
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah.
The vice president level. Like, you know, I saw a lot of support earlier this evening online for Kevin Martinez, who's overseen marketing for them, to be the new president of the team. So there are members of the organization, I think, that have quite high approval ratings, but, you know, to the extent that we know what they're doing on the inside. But so I don't want to, you know, paint everyone in the organization with this brush. But if you're someone who had the power to decide on whether Kevin Mather was the president and CEO, I think it is fair.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking John Stanton, Chuck Armstrong here, right? I'm not talking about fucking people who I don't know of in the Mariners, including Kevin Mather, but people who I don't know of within the Mariners organization. I don't think that every single person within the Mariners organization is a bad person, right?
I'm glad you've clarified that.
Yeah. But also, a lot of these things are kind of just Trojan horses to draw the tension away from everything that the organization has done wrong over these last two decades, which is to say basically everything that the organization has done wrong over the last two decades. It's like, here, you can have your local foods and your craft beer because we focus grouped and realized that people wanted those, but it doesn't make up for the fact that basically everything on the field and at the executive level has been entirely wrong. And the Mariners have given no reason to cheer for them as a team, right? To care about them as a team. And I think the players in particular, like, I look at this and I see how the players have reacted. And I'm like, fuck yeah, Marco Gonzalez, right? It's like, I want to cheer for Jared Kelenic, right? And I want to cheer for Julio Rodriguez. And I want to cheer for Marco Gonzalez. And I think that's the most important thing, is caring about those players. Because those players are not the ones that are going out of their way to say, we're not going to support the Seahawks. We're not going to cheer for basketball to come back in Seattle. Those players shouldn't be held accountable for this, because they haven't done anything wrong. It is at the organizational core and at the highest levels. That's what the issue is with the Mariners. And that has been the case for two decades plus.
I think the other thing I want to say is this has made me reflect a little bit because, you know, obviously one of the big criticisms of these comments from Kevin Mather is that, you know, a lot of them treat the players as lines on a financial spreadsheet and not as human beings. And I don't think that we outside the organization are immune to that. Obviously Kevin Mather's perspective is not informed by analytics and the sabermetric movement, but there is an element of, you know, removing the individual and dehumanizing to that I think we have to constantly be sensitive to. And one of the things that's been irking me lately is every night on Twitter when the Lakers lose, Wesley Matthews and Marc Gasol are trending. Every time the Sixers lose, Danny Green trends. Every time the Celtics lose, Brad Stevens trends. And it's fans blaming these individuals for their team's shortcomings. And I just think we've got to get out of this mentality of constantly castigating and assigning blame.
All of sports is broken.
So let's continue talking about sports.
It's true. Is it not true that that's the case? There are certain players who it'll never happen to, who have become anointed or whatever among the fans. And then there's certain players who are long-term role players or whatever, who can get 100% of the blame and people are going to be pissed off about. Honestly, this whole fucking thing is stupid. Like, really, when you take a step back and think about it, why do we even care, right? What does it matter? What does the whole thing matter? It's just like, and I really, really think these comments made me think to myself, okay, I hate the Mariners. I hate everything about this organization. I don't care at all about this organization. But who do I care about? I care about Marco Gonzalez, right? And I care about Kyle Lewis. And I care about, in basketball, I care about Damian Lillard. I was like, why the fuck am I watching this team that is really just a tax haven for billionaires or whatever, right? It's like, why do I care if the Blazers win? Why do I care if the Mariners win? Which I don't. For the record, I do not care if the Mariners win. But it's just like, why would I care at all? And it's like, you know what? Damian Lillard hitting a 43, that is exciting. That's what I care about.
Anthony Edwards dunking on Utah Watanabe.
And yes, right? Like, I don't care about Anthony Edwards' stat line, right? But that was
three of 14, 0 of 7 for 3.
Thrilling to see, right? Like something that you could not see in any other scenario in life, right?
I yelled.
Yeah, exactly. And it really comes down to Kyle Lewis growing as a baseball player, like, and being an exciting baseball player and playing in our city, right? Having the opportunity, if there are ever, wait, what was the number? 9,870 or whatever. There are ever 9,000. I will not be one of those fans. But if there ever is a full stadium of fans and it's safe, I might be there watching Kyle Lewis play baseball. And that's what we care about. We don't give a fuck about Kevin Mather. We don't give a fuck about Chuck Armstrong and John Stanton. They do not matter.
They put Howard Lincoln in this. You can't see this and not put Howard Lincoln.
I don't know enough about the Mariners to even know the names. But Howard Lincoln, right? Those people do not matter. What matters is the players on the field seeing something that we've never seen before, seeing Nelson Cruz hit a baseball 450 feet or whatever, right? That is a thrilling moment. Howard Lincoln is just a person who's trying to feed off all of this, right? John Stanton is just a person who's trying to feed off
all of this. Let's be careful with this, because if you get too far with this definition, I'm just a person who's trying to feed off of this.
ESPN's Kevin Pelton is just, but that is, and it really distilled down to it, because I was feeling very down about the idea of sport in general after this moment. And I was like, is all of this just a pyramid scheme to get people like Kevin Mather promoted and paid? You know what I mean? And I don't think that's the case. I think it is a lot about seeing these thrilling moments that we see in sport. And that's why we care, right? The things that we could never do ourselves. Hitting a baseball really far, throwing a pitch so fast, right? It's something that we could never do ourselves. And that is an exciting thing. And people have worked their entire lives to that moment. Kyle Lewis has worked his entire life to that moment to be able and go up and save a home run. And pieces of shit like Kevin Mather have done nothing to get there, right? They have just fallen their way up. He didn't do what Kyle Lewis did. He didn't have that kind of commitment. Right. And I think that is the important piece. And there is a reason to pay attention to sports beyond just how bad the executives are at basically every single professional sports franchise in all of American professional sports.
All right.
Is that, am I wrong? Am I wrong about this?
No, you're not wrong. I mean, I don't think that every executive in professional sports is bad.
That's not exactly what I'm saying. There obviously are good executives, but they just don't work for the Seattle Mariners
at the highest levels. So one of the things that bumps me out about
nominations
is injuries. And we got a really, really brutal one on Saturday when Jordan Morris suffered a tear of his left ACL in Swansea City's loss at Huddersfield. The opposite ACL of the one he previously tore in 2018, costing him that entire MLS season. And this was a moment where Jordan Morris was poised to take his career to an entirely different level, to go over to Europe. You know, he was excited about this opportunity and we were excited for him. And now it seems like that moment is going to be lost as he's out through the start of the European season in 2021-22. And it seems like he's going to come back to the Sounders at the end of his loan and we'll see what happens from there.
It's fucking bullshit.
Right. I mean, there's no one to be mad at in this case.
No. It just sucks. It sucks how fast it happened. And I find myself empathizing with Jordan Morris himself and having this type of injury and being in a new place and being around new people. And it's like, if I personally was to have suffered an injury as badly as this, I would really want to be around people that I knew very well.
Well, he's going to come back, I think, to Seattle for the rehab process. So,
but just the moment, right?
Yeah.
The most important moment is when he was being injured. And if it was in Seattle, he would have known everybody around him. And
his dad would have been the team doctor treating him.
Really?
Yeah, his dad is the team doctor. Did you not know that?
No. But right, he has history and experience with Schmetz, and apparently the team doctor knows him pretty well. Yeah. But his teammates and everybody like that, and that's the piece where it's like, thinking about this and trying to put myself into Jordan Morris's perspective, if I was going to be seriously injured, I would really want that to happen around people that I knew very well. Right.
I mean, to me, the big thing of it is having already gone through this process, knowing how difficult it is, and then coming back even better after his ACL injury in 2018, and then to have it happen again at this moment. Yeah. I mean, it's devastating.
I don't think it necessarily means that Jordan Morris won't be back after this, right? An ACL tear.
Oh, I mean, he'll be back on the pitch, of course. Yeah, I mean, he'll play, but I don't know if he's going to have that same opportunity at the highest level of European soccer going forward. I mean, we'll see. Hopefully he will. Hopefully I'll be wrong about that, but that's the fear. So from the Sounders' perspective, Swansea will continue to pay Morris's salary the remainder of the six-month loan, which gives the Sounders a slight break with regard to the MLS salary cap, I think about $500,000. But the team was surely planning for him to be sold this summer, which would have given them more flexibility to replace him during the mid-season transfer window, which is the primary transfer window for the rest of the world. That now seems uncertain. The Sounders could place Morris on the season-ending injury list, which allows them to spend up to $250,000 on a replacement. They don't have to decide on that until the close of the primary transfer window on June 1st. The Sounders will be back and beginning training on Monday. Some Ole Reign news. They're adding longtime England keeper Karen Bardsley on a short-term loan from Manchester City through June 30th. Bardsley had lost her starting job with City and covers over the period before the Reign add another international keeper, as confirmed by OL owner Fareed Benstidi, widely expected to be OL's Sarah Bouadi, as we talked about a few weeks ago on the podcast. So going to have an experienced international keeper in goal for the Reign pretty much all season. Should we talk about UW sports? Let's start with softball, which suffered its first loss of the season in the Dixie State Classic on Friday, falling 8-5 to Nevada in a game started by Kelly Lynch. Gabby Plain did get touched for a pair of runs as a reliever in that one. The Huskies rebounded to win their next three games by a combined 36-1 score. All of them run ruled. Plain got 14 of her 15 outs via strikeout and a 9-0 win over host Dixie State.
That's right, Dixie State. You watch out.
Huskies will spend this weekend in San Diego playing three games at San Diego State on Friday and Saturday and a doubleheader Sunday at the University of San Diego. Also, UW broke ground last Thursday on a softball performance center. The fully donor-funded facility, which will be next to the Dempsey Center, will allow the team to train year-round indoors.
Can you explain to me where this is going to be?
So you know when we're walking into the stadium, when we're going into the east end zone, it'll be kind of on the left as we're turning from facing, like walking directly towards Husky Stadium to walking down so that we go to the east end zone entrance by Husky Softball Stadium.
Okay, so tell me I'm stashing a beer somewhere. Where is it in relation to that?
It is very similar to where you have, near where you have stashed beers previously.
There really is space. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of space around there for.
I guess there is. I don't know.
Building.
It's been a minute since I've been there in person.
Okay. So I have a beer in my hand, a beer in my pocket, and then a second beer in my pocket. And at least one of those I'm going to try to drink in line before we go in. The one in my hand I've already finished before we made it to the line. Dear. The one that's in my pouch, I need to stash that somewhere. That's where the softball
performance center.
Performance center is going to be
pretty much yes.
Okay, I feel like that checks out, but okay, let's say I've got a bottle of wine.
When have you ever had a bottle of wine?
I think there might have been an apple cup or two.
Oh boy.
Look, okay, it's not 750 milliliters. I have got a half gallon, and I need to drink that down with the help of a few friends and stash it somewhere. How close is that going to be to the softball facility?
Pretty close.
College sports are great.
Oh, we are really off the rails now. All right, UW women's basketball got a 78-61 win on Friday against Utah, their highest scoring outing since December, behind 22 points from Haley Van Dyke. Suffered a 55-50 loss on Sunday to Colorado on Senior Day, and will wrap up the Pac-12 regular season schedule on Sunday at Washington State, needing a win in Pullman to have a chance to move up from 11th in the Pac-12 standings entering the conference tournament. The Cougars, who finished a game back of UW last season, are poised to make an NCAA tournament appearance for the second time in program history with a 500 conference record. Their other appearance was in 1991 as a number 11 seed.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's been WSU women's basketball, not a proud tradition.
I'm freaking cheering for them at this point.
Go Cougs. UW men's basketball suffered a 79-61 loss last Thursday versus Stanford, then got a 62-51 win on Saturday versus Cal on Senior Day, where Travis Rice, the walk-on and son of assistant coach Dave Rice, got the start and knocked down a three on the opening possession. Very exciting. Quade Green and Hamir Wright, typical starters, joined Rice in going through Senior Day festivities. All three players have the option of returning next season, but I haven't seen anything indicating they will. So it sounds like they're going to move on after this season, having a relatively normal senior season. The Huskies then headed to the desert, where they were playing a back-to-back set at Arizona State to make up the game that was postponed in Seattle earlier this season when the Sun Devils were shut down due to COVID-19. And they started that off with a 97-64 loss on Tuesday night, which was their worst loss since 2000 in the Mike Hopkins era. But the good news is they get another crack at Arizona State on Thursday.
There we go.
You know what they say? It's really hard to beat an opponent twice in a row. It's not true at all, but they do say that.
By 33 points.
Yeah, that is true. That 100% is true. Saturday, they will finish their regular season schedule at Arizona on CBS. They've let this team on national television, network television, for a second time this season. I don't know why they've done so. The Huskies then will have a weekend off, it looks like, before the Pac-12 men's basketball tournament.
Are they they're playing that? You're feeling like
they are. They have announced they are playing that. Arizona will not be participating because they have self-imposed a postseason ban this year. So it'll be 11 teams. The Huskies have a chance to finish 10th in the standings
ahead of Cal.
Cal, yes.
Cal seems really bad.
Cal could still jump ahead of them with a win this weekend. So we'll
when you're considering who to vote for, I have this beautiful framed piece here from Katie. When you're considering who to vote for in the podcast MVP, just remember that this weekend, that Katie chatted to us that the Husky basketball team could win the Pac-12 tournament.
Did she?
Just keep that in mind. this was a thing, and especially because of the emergence of Travis Rice, KD felt like the Husky basketball team had put it all together and would win the Pac-12 men's basketball tournament.
I'm not sure if this is apocryphal or not. Should we remember 2003-04?
Absolutely, we should.
Back in 2004, the Huskies hosted the Cougars on a Thursday and struggled in this one, trailing 67-61 with 104 left to play. Will Conroy made a three on the following possession, and Bobby Jones made a layup to pull within 67-66 with 45.2 seconds left. Then the Huskies forced another turnover, and Mike Jensen made the go-ahead three with 19.9 seconds left. Conroy made a pair of free throws in the final seconds to seal the improbable 71-67 win, giving the Huskies their first sweep of WSU in 4 years at the time.
Holy shit. This team just pulled out these games.
I don't remember this one at all.
But as you explained to me, we're not supposed to remember these games. We're supposed to...
We don't need to remember these games.
It's literally called Let's Remember 2003, 2004. But
the remembering is like remembering what happened because we don't remember. Now we're saying, remembering.
In fact, let's just change the name of the statement to Let's Revisit 2003, 2004.
This was another one that the Sonics were playing a home game opposite, so I was not in attendance, and that's why I do not remember this at all.
I feel like I have a vague memory of this game, though. And this was the time period where I think I started paying more attention to Husky basketball than Sonics basketball.
The Sonics lost 112-101 to Philadelphia. Allen Iverson scored 40 points. Glenn Robinson had 26. Also, I got to be honest, I do not really remember Glenn Robinson playing for the Sixers.
Big time.
Eric Snow started at point guard.
It wasn't that you didn't remember this game. You don't remember Big Dog playing at all for the team.
Not at all. Eric Snow had 7 points and 7 assists for the Sixers. The Sonics... Let's see here. We're led by 31 points and 11 rebounds from Ray Allen, but had only one other starter, Rashard Lewis, in double figures.
God, I love Ray Allen. Okay.
But now we get to a game that I do legitimately remember.
Well, I just want... are we going to talk about Mike Jensen?
We're going to talk about... Well, let's talk about Mike Jensen later.
Okay.
This came up on Twitter in relation to the UW-Stanford game, so I want to save that conversation for that. So the early rivalry game in the weekend gave the Huskies the opportunity to travel across the country for a rare February non-conference game at North Carolina State on Sunday. Then coached by future Pac-12 rival Herb Sendek, noted Herb, and ranked 13th in the country, Herb Immunity, featuring eventual ACC Player of the Week, Player of the Year, I should say, Julius Hodge.
Hodge. It looked like an NBA star.
Oh, 100%. Also Sonic Summer Leaguer, Julius Hodge. The Wolfpack came in 9-3 in ACC play and would earn a number 3 seed in the NCAA tournament before being upset in the second round by Vanderbilt. But they got a test from these upstart Huskies. A back-and-forth game saw Washington lead 34-31 at the break and by as many as 8 points. NC State rallied to tie the game, and after Brandon Roy missed a jumper with 19 seconds left, they scored the go-ahead points at the free throw line and ended up winning 77-72. Bobby Jones scored 22 points on 10 of 13 shooting and surely led the defensive charge against Hodge, who was held to 11 points. But this game was memorable for one play and one play only. And that is Nate Robinson's perfectly timed tip dunk midway through the second half of a close game.
Do you have a YouTube video of this play?
I do have a YouTube video of this play.
Send it over.
Would you like me to G-chat it to you?
Yeah, send it on the Zoom chat. I'll watch that right now. Can we get real audio here?
Oh,
there's only one other person in the chat. You can't accidentally send it to somebody specifically. You could send it to everyone.
Yes, but I have to get the status bar to come up.
Nate Robinson is so little. Like, I just can't even watching these plays, how tiny he was in hindsight.
I mean, yeah, he's 5'9" officially, and he's shorter than that.
Good God. I don't remember that dunk at all.
I
remember the NC State game the next year much better.
For sure. But I remember we watched this game at our grandparents' house on the TV in their room.
I have no recollection of this.
No, I distinctly remember it watching on that Sunday afternoon. The next year was opposite the Sonics Christmas party. So I watched it before going to the Sonics.
I remember
Christmas
listening party. To it in the car.
Wow. What a moment. Imagine listening to things. You weren't even streaming it. So this was like a moment where like they had just barely beat Wazoo. Like they had won a lot of Pac-10 games, but you weren't sure how good this team was. And then this was a situation against like a team that you could legitimately face in the second round of the NCAA tournament. And they held their own on the road. It was like, this team is for real moment, even though they lost.
No, and I don't, I mean, that's a tough game traveling across the country.
Yeah.
I don't know how Julius Hodge rated right by your stats, but
I don't think I have a full projection for him.
Julius Hodge seemed like at the time, like what an NBA player should seem like. Right. We definitely felt like Julius Hodge, and he was a pretty high draft pick, but maybe just never had the offensive ability to really put it together. But
I think he probably wasn't quite athletic enough. He was a little Evan Turner-ish, I guess I would say.
Like he was in the draft, Evan Turner. Like,
well, Evan Turner did not play like the second pick of the draft.
Tell that to the Blazers' victory over the Thunder 2 years ago.
Oh, shouts to Evan Turner. The other thing is he didn't shoot threes.
Apologize to Evan Turner.
He made 14 threes in 34 games as a senior at a 26% clip. So that did not speak well to Julius Hodge's ability to translate to the NBA three-point line.
Did Kawhi shoot threes in college?
No, but then he went to the Spurs. Kawhi did so much other stuff, though. Kawhi was one of the great all-time prospects. Not really great all-time prospects, but one of the underrated all-time prospects.
I will say that Julius Hodge felt like what Kawhi felt like. At the time, maybe we didn't know about him because
no, Kawhi was such a good defender, though. Like
Julius Hodge
was gonna be
felt like an excellent defender.
I don't remember that.
I remember feeling like Julius Hodge was going to be a great NBA player.
Yeah, I don't have any thoughts. I like this was not a period I was writing about the draft, so I don't have any thoughts that I can share about Julius Hodge as a draft pick. Or an NBA
prospect.
Just wait
until we get to the Michael Sweetney era.
Oh, well, the Sweetney era was earlier than that. The problem was I wasn't working full-time for the Sonics yet, which I was at the time Hodge was drafted.
That's why they signed him.
Yes, I was really influential in that. Let's wrap up by talking about the Seahawks and specifically about KJ Wright, who's been making the rounds on the national radio shows this week.
What the fuck? Why does this happen to the Seahawks? Does this happen to other teams?
I assume the KJ Wright is just trying to establish to people like, hey, I'm out there. Come sign me.
Why do other teams have players who just happen to be making the rounds when they have shit to say?
I think they come up with shit to say to make the rounds. That on the Jim Rome show on Monday.
The Jim Rome show still exists?
It does, yes.
What Wright's, fucking year is it?
Wright said he wouldn't take a hometown discount to re-sign with the team, saying, quote, no way, man. I do way too much on the football field to take a discount. It makes absolutely no sense. He did also say in that interview, I mean, that would just be a beautiful story if I could just ride it all out with the Seahawks. That's some legendary stuff. On Tuesday, he was on SiriusXM NFL radio saying that he's looking for a multi-year deal and has not yet had any contract talks with the Seahawks. He expects them to wait to do business until free agency opens next month. I will say, as well as KJ Wright played last season, and KJ Wright was awesome last season, I expect him to be disappointed by the market for his services, given the salary cap situation, which he is obviously well aware of, and related to that, the number of veterans who will likely be released by teams to create cap space, therefore creating a glut of free agents relative to the amount of money available. So...
seems reasonable.
Now, one thing I think we do often see in this situation, we've seen it probably with the Seahawks, is when the market doesn't develop as you expect, it's pretty rare that you kind of go back to your old team for less money than you were hoping. In those situations, I think it's more likely you go somewhere else.
I think KJ Wright might be a different scenario.
We'll see. I went back and re-listened to our end of the season podcast where we all predicted he was coming back. I got to say, I've changed my vote on that one.
I'm not there yet.
Okay, well, that's good. That's optimistic. Where's your vote on Russell Wilson leaving the Seahawks this offseason?
It's not. Are you kidding me? You're trying to drum up a little something here. Look,
I'm not trying to drum up a little.
We're talking about baseball. Come on. Russell Wilson is not. It was like there was a thing. Somebody tweeted that conversations with the Seahawks about Russell Wilson would have to start at 3 first round draft picks, and it's like, no fucking way. 3 first round draft picks is not anywhere near enough. It would have to start at 3 first round draft picks plus a young potential star quarterback plus additional young star players. Like, it's just, it's not happening. It's not a conversation that needs to happen.
Russell, I'm not Wilson at 100% not, anymore.
I'm at like, 100%.
I'm at like 95.
Russell Wilson is not getting traded.
Okay.
How much of his bonus would the Seahawks have to eat also?
It would be impractical for them to trade him this offseason.
It's stupid. It's fanciful that we're even having this conversation. I understand that we're in the era of quarterbacks getting traded, but like, we're in the era of quarterbacks that could legitimately be considered the worst starting quarterback in the NFL getting traded and still drawing value for that, right? Like, the Eagles still got some value for, obviously they're eating a large amount, but they were eating a large amount of bonus money, you know, the most ever of bonus money that they were eating by trading Carson Wentz, but they still got value back in picks. And that is for a quarterback who by some measures was the worst starting quarterback in the NFL. There's nobody comparable to Russell Wilson.
The Seahawks would take an additional $7 million cap hit if they traded Russell Wilson, because $39 million would accelerate. His current cap number is $32
million. That's actually not that bad.
It's not as bad as I thought off the top of my head either.
It's not Carson Wentz numbers. But
the Seahawks also don't have as much cap space as the Eagles do. Or maybe they do.
It's not going to happen. It doesn't matter. It's not going to happen. It's a pretense.
I mean, I hope that's the case, but... The Seahawks have not come out and said it's not happening. And that would be nice to see if they do that.
Who cares? There's no smoke. There's no fire. It's not happening.
There's definitely smoke. But there may not be a fire. I still think this is a 1 in 20 chance, to be clear. I just don't think it's zero anymore.
KJ Wright is a much more present story. And
of course. That's why we led with it.
I still think there's a very good, very, I think what you're saying about KJ Wright, about the market developing, is probably true. And, he's a veteran linebacker. Like, will there be teams that are interested? Of course. But will there be teams that are interested at the number that KJ Wright is looking for?
And in a multi-year deal?
Yeah, I'm a little bit more skeptical about that. I think the most obvious situation is coming back to Seattle. If he leaves, I think that would be a big loss for the Seahawks defense.
For sure, based on the way he played last season.
But they also, they drafted Jordan Brooks, and they've drafted a lot of linebackers over these last handful of years with the understanding that KJ Wright is not going to be the long-term option, you know? Like, they've been drafting KJ Wright's replacement for quite a few years in a row.
I mean, not as many years as a row as the Bears missed the playoffs, but.
Well, do you know who the fucking Seahawks were playing on their team when the last time the Mariners missed the playoffs? KJ Wright was like 6 years old.
He was a little older than six. He was 12 the last time they made the playoffs.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah. How old do you think KJ Wright is now? You know that it's been 20 years since the Seahawks have made the playoffs. You know that KJ Wright is older than 26. That's not even hard math. So, well,
I don't know. This is the deep down time for the NFL. Like, we could try to drum up stories. You know, Jason Lockenfor can tweet whatever he wants to tweet, but this is the time period when, look, Carson Wentz got traded. Let's get whatever mileage we can out of that. Mac Jones is maybe going to be a top 10 pick in the draft. I'm pretty skeptical, but this is the time period when the NFL takes a back seat for a little while, for at least 3 to 4 weeks. And we'll see what happens.
We sure will. We always do. On that note,
thanks for listening. I'm fucking steamed here after this Mariners conversation.
Wow.
I didn't think I would be. I didn't. We got to places that... Do you ever, as somebody who writes about sports professionally for a living, think about why you care about sports?
No.
You're called the machine for a reason.
Oh, no. I mean, the time I have that feeling is like when I read stories about like racism in English soccer. There was a feature in ESPN, the magazine, a few years ago, and then I went to a Sounders game the next night, and it was like, okay, obviously we're not overtly chanting racist things out there, but still, like, to direct hate towards other players is like, why are we doing this? Just because they're on the other team? Like, I totally get wanting your team to win, but hating the other team is the thing that I never get.
Tribalism.
I mean, I get it. Yes, I understand it, but I don't know logically because why would it happen?
There's much deeper seated tribalism in British soccer than there is in anything American.
There is, but it's still like we have to boo when a player goes down late in a match because it could be time wasting. But what if the guy actually just broke his leg and gets stretchered off? Like, are we really going to miss out that much if you didn't boo the player for time wasting on the small chance that maybe it wasn't actually time wasting and actually they were seriously injured?
The booing does nothing.
No, it's like the risk is huge and the reward is nothing.
In England, I think, and probably in Europe in general, sports are probably, I mean, they all come from the same place. I think sports are more, let's say soccer is more tribalistic and historical. In America, it all boils down to capitalism, though. Like, American sports,
there's so much longer history.
But also those teams, a team doesn't move in British soccer, right?
This is true.
Tranmere Rovers ain't going anywhere. You know what I mean? Like
there are a few teams that have moved, but it's very rare. And they're not moving like all the way from Seattle to Oklahoma City.
You can't hold a city hostage in the same way in British soccer as you can in American professional sports. American professional sports really boil down to something amazing in exchange for capitalism.
Which is weird that we are so, socialistic in terms of we have to have draft picks for fairness, which is just not a concept at all in European sports. I mean, obviously many people have observed that, but.
Yeah, the trade-off of like, yeah, I don't know, that's kind of interesting. But I think the difference is you have wealthy people, which is true of European soccer, but you have wealthy.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you're aware of this. A lot of the English clubs are they're owned by Americans now.
but the wealthy people are buying into British soccer, understanding what the deal is. But you're buying into American professional sports, being like, "Hey, I want a fair shake here," right? Like, you're going into it with the perspective of like, if I'm bad, I
deserve this.
Next year.
Yes.
Yeah. If I'm bad, I'll get something good the next year, right? There's a great flattening that happens in American professional sports, except for college, of course. But